Welcome once again to Word on the Hills, with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Stephanie Bell Boissonneau. Each week, we visit with a local author, get an introduction to their work, sometimes a glimpse into their lives. We find out what prompts them to write, and give them an opportunity to read from their work. We're very pleased to have Stephanie with us today. Welcome, Stephanie. Stephanie Bell Boissonneau has some formal training in creative writing from courses at Concordia and McGill Universities. She has participated in writing and reading groups for over 30 years. Raising her family in Montreal, she and her husband now live near Campbellford, Ontario, continuing their passion for historical house restoration, gourmet cooking, and organically homegrown vegetables. Stephanie also participates in local community and family activities. She's had two short stories published with Hidden Brook Press in their anthology series, Reflections on the Past, and a flash fiction piece that appeared in The Link last year. Let's start by talking about your history of South Lake, telling tales. Where is South Lake, and what's your special connection to it?
It was surveyed in 1859, and it's a little lake just south of the town of Minden in Snowdon Township, Haliburton County. My father, in 1954, bought land on that lake and to build a cottage for my mother and his then two little girls. This became our family cottage, and in June, we'd pack up the car and head to the lake for the summers. My mom would stay there with us while my dad would travel back and forth from Toronto, spending weekends with us at the cottage. I still own land up in Haliburton. I have a close friend who lives on South Lake, and my sister lives in the village of Haliburton, so that's pretty much my connection.
Pretty close connections there. So what inspired you to do all the research required and convert the material you have into a book?
Several years ago, a close friend of mine asked me to do a little history on South Lake, and I agreed because I had close ties to the lake and I had very good memories of my summers there. It was something that was going to be made available to the cottagers who are living on the lake today. I might add that some of those cottages are people who lived there back in the 50s, and they've kept cottages and passed them on to their children. I love research, and once I got busy with it, I was consumed. And I have to say my friend was kind of wondering what was taking me so long, because she thought I was only going to write a pamphlet, and I ended up writing a book. I contacted families that had been present there since the 1930s, and some of those families had parents who had been there since long before that. I spoke with people I knew from my years on the lake when I cottaged there, and this would have been during the years of 1950 to 1970. And I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to spend time at my girlfriend's cottage on the lake, so it gave me the chance to do a lot of research on site. I could use the local library, the newspaper office, and visit with residents that are still living there. When I wasn't able to be there, I'd give my friend a quick call, and she'd run into town and get me the information I needed.
A lot of your material is genealogical, isn't it? You've got material there in the book about the actual settlers. Does it relate to the families who have lived there ever since, or did you just associate it with a particular farm or cottage? Now the cottage belongs to a completely different family.
Well, actually, to give you the background to this, my original goal was to write just a historical account of the area from the homesteaders on. And originally there were 13 farms around South Lake, 13 different families, who some of them moved away, some of them remained there. Once I got into this, I realized that there was an awful lot of oral history that I thought had to be delved into as well. And that's when I decided, rather than just write a history of the area, I wanted to pepper it with tales of what it was like living on the lake at different times. So the historical part came from my researched books, Ontario censuses, births, death records, cemeteries, and family websites. But I also had a great interest in what had happened to South Lake over the years. It started out as poor farmers living on this lake. 50s and 60s, it morphed into lodges and cottages for vacationing Toronto people. And then today, it's changed again. It's more people retiring, and a lot of the old cottages and lodges have been ripped down, and big homes are in their place now.
Do you have an audience, do you think, apart from the cottages?
Probably not a great deal. Now, I did a very small printing of this book because I felt that my audience would be rather small. I have had other people interested in it. There have been numerous people that have passed through South Lake over the years. And of course, some of those people were very interested in it. I had a woman who was a historian who has written several novels on the history of Haliburton County, and she actually endorsed my book, and she thought it was something of interest, and she passed it on to people she knew. So the audience did grow somewhat, but I really was only expecting a very small audience when I started.
Mm-hmm. Well, you self-published Telling Tales. What were the challenges of doing that?
Self-publishing was really quite a huge challenge for me. I'm not particularly computer savvy. I know a little bit about it, but not a great deal. Unfortunately, my husband helped in that area, but for both of us, it was a big learning curve. We had a budget to consider. While I didn't mind doing the work myself at no cost, I didn't want it to cost me a lot either, so I had to look for a place that would publish it that wouldn't cost too much. I had to also find people that would edit for me and donate their time as well, which I was fortunate enough to be able to find these people. And I had to consider that I couldn't make the book too expensive because people wouldn't buy it if it was too expensive. It had to be something that people could afford to have and would want to have around. So that was pretty much some of the challenges that I had with it. I also, one of the things I wanted, though, was I wanted a nice-looking book. And so we were very happy with what we came up with. My husband and I did all the graphics and the layout for the book itself. And once it was published, we were actually quite happy with how it came out.
Well, it certainly got a very attractive cover. I was most impressed by it. Read us some of the inside so we can be impressed with that too.
Okay, my first piece, I was thinking near Christmas time, and one of my people who wrote for the book was a fellow by the name of George Pratt, and he was someone who lived up there, and he wrote his story called A Moment of Christmas, and that's the one I'd like to read at this time. Starting in late November, preparations for the concert were taken up in a frenzy, which by late December developed into a fever. The plays and songs and recitations were selected from old manuscripts kept in the teachers' desks, all specimens of Victorian rectitude, be assured, for indeed they were that old. They were dusted off and duly memorized and practiced, an enterprise that provided a welcome relief from our normal routine of no-nonsense book learning. Of all the preparations, it seemed to me we labored longest over the drawings of our poster. Painstakingly scribed on standard sheets of foolscap, the lettering touted the concert in rustic kid print, the composite product of all 8 students in 5 grades. Holly leaves and berries were drawn ever so imaginatively around the border by the older kids and candy canes in the corners by the younger ones. The last line of the poster, its motley color, calculated to elicit excitement, exhorted, come one, come all, in a wildly imaginative script that was closer to a hieroglyphic. We proudly distributed our posters all the way from Walter Ireland's stone house, a mile past the school, closer to Minden, to Earnberry's log house, 3 miles away toward Gallert. All was now ready for the Christmas concert at the Bat Lake School. We had run all the way home at 4 o'clock to scrub and dress in our best clothes, which, for every one of us, were hand-me-downs, but all freshly washed and hauled in by Mum off the frozen line when the snow had started that afternoon. We gave no thought to supper. We knew that at the concert there would be food, savory food of rare variety, followed by desserts beyond imagining. food in abundance, prepared and brought in tea towel-covered 6-quart baskets by the women round. The excitement was no longer a fever, it was exquisite pain. We would travel back to the school in what we called a jumper, a small one-horse sledge. It was 8 feet long, and it looked like an overgrown child's sled. It was the only transportation we owned. We started the long pull to the school. Bob and Bill had stayed behind to keep the fire going in the box stove. Fred, Donnie, Shirley, and I alternately rode and scampered alongside as old Mick trudged steadily through the deepening snow. He knew the jumper was padded with hay that he would get to eat when we got to wherever we were going. The coal oil lantern hanging on the back of the jumper radiated a pale yellow glow that produced an altogether pleasing sparkle in the snowflakes. The wafting warm smell of the flickering wick was a sharp contrast to the pristine evergreen scent of the pine forest around us. Although no Christmas card could portray a seasonal scene more compelling, there was nothing special about it to us. It was just the way we did things. After most of a mile, we presently came abreast of the Hamilton Farm gate, whence Dad stopped to give Mick a rest. And there occurred a magical happening that has remained imprinted on my soul to this day. We sat quietly for a few minutes as the snow wisped gently upon us, everyone bewitched by the silence of the inky night, pressing in on the glow of our lantern. But then, like God's whisper, floating across the invisible pasture, came a faint sound of tinkling bells, which could only just be heard over the noise of old Mick snuffling and blowing in the dark. The tinkling grew louder, now clearly moving down the lane towards us. Through a filter of snowflakes, we could see a faint loom of a lantern. It was the Hamiltons, for they too were heading out to the concert. Their two grand Clydesdales, Ginger and Pretty Boy, were hitched to the sleigh, resolutely pulling the stout Jesse Hamilton and her equally stout brother Walt Donnelly, with his wife Winnie, all perched on a straw palliasse under a blanket. We could not see them, only the glow of their lantern, but we could hear the bells, the joyous tinkling of the Christmas bells, trembling where Walt had fixed them to the rumps of those great draft horses. At the age of 8, when my head should have been awhirl with thoughts of Christmas bounty waiting at the school, I was mesmerized by the moment. If angels had begun heralding from the skies, as it is said they did on another night long ago, I could not have beset by a greater rapture. We let them go ahead to break the path, then Dad chipped the go-ahead to Mick. He dropped his head and heaved on the traces to pull us steadily behind them. The only sound was the occasional snuffle from the horse and the bells tinkling their snowy serenade to the quiet forest that surrounded us. Of life at South Lake, and of 65 Christmases since, I have no more poignant memory.
That was lovely, Stephanie. Now we'll take a short break.